Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with biographer Robert Caro about the fourth volume in his epic about Lyndon B. Johnson.
Everybody who knew Lyndon Johnson knew that while most of the time he yelled and screamed over every little thing, and if he had a cold, you'd think he was dying of pneumonia. But they also knew that when things were tough, Lady Bird said he's a good man to have around when things get tough.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Charlotte Rogan discusses her first novel, The Lifeboat.
She's been called everything from an anti-heroine to an antagonist. One person called her evil, and then there was a lovely woman on Twitter who said she was the most endearing, honest character she'd come across in a long time.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. For more than 30 years, Robert Caro, one of America's foremost historians, has been writing an epic biography of Lyndon B. Johnson. The newest installment, The Passage of Power, has just been published. It's reviewed on our cover by former President Bill Clinton, who calls it a brilliant book filled with sparkling detail, and adds, with this fascinating and meticulous account of how and why Johnson did what he did, Robert Caro has once again done America a great service. I'm delighted that Bob Caro is here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Yeah, it's great to be here and great to hear those words.
Well, let's talk about power. Bill Clinton knows as much about it as any living man. Yet in your new volume, Passage to Power, for several hundred pages, when Lyndon Johnson is vice president, he's actually stripped of power. Why tell us so much about those years?
Well, for one thing, it's just a human story. He was the second most powerful man in the country, a Senate majority leader. He trades it in for the vice presidency and finds himself humiliated day by day. Kennedy aides won't talk to him. They exclude him from meetings. You know what his nickname was among the Kennedy people? Rufus Cornpone.
Why, Bob? Why did they treat Lyndon Johnson, this powerful, effective legislator, maybe the greatest legislator in American history, with such contempt and disrespect?
You know, you say the greatest legislator in American history. The Kennedy program in Congress, the tax bill, the civil rights bill, is completely stalled.
They never asked for his help.
They never asked for his help. They never asked for his advice. When Kennedy introduces the civil rights bill and it's stalled, then someone thinks to ask him, and he says, you know, I don't even know what's in this bill. I had to read about it in the New York Times.
He had not been given a draft or copy at any stage.
No.
Why did they do this?
That's a complicated question, and part of it is just fear. You know, they had seen Lyndon Johnson in his great days when he ran the Senate, and they knew. You know, Bobby Kennedy once said, he's walking out of the Senate office building at night. He's a young staffer. Johnson is the great majority leader. Bobby Kennedy thinks he works harder than anyone. He looks back at the building and there's one light burning in the Capitol, and it's Lyndon Johnson's office, and he says to the man with him, no one outworks Lyndon. And I think there was a real element of fear. They were afraid if they ever let him get started, they wouldn't be able to control him. So they never let him get started.
And then, Bob, the great moment comes, and it's part of your brilliance as a narrator, as a dramatic narrator, that you actually have your reader, who, as Bill Clinton says, I think quite strikingly, for the first time actually pities Lyndon Johnson.
Yes.
Waiting for him to ascend to the presidency.
Yes.
In maybe what is the single most traumatic moment in American history.
In American history. This, and you know, there have been, 1,000 books on the assassination. But the story from Lyndon Johnson's viewpoint, no one knows that story. I mean, no one knows that when the first shot rings out and Kennedy starts to fall over in his car, that the Secret Service agent in Johnson's car vaults over the back of the front seat, grabs Johnson by the shoulder, throws him to the floor, and basically lies on top of him until they get to Parkland Hospital, shielding Johnson with his own body. No one knows that Johnson is standing alone in a cubicle in this hospital for 40 minutes. He doesn't know if the president is alive or dead, doesn't know, therefore, whether he is president. I mean, these scenes, to me, I said, how can nobody know this?
Well, how did you find it out? Now, something your readers know is almost as fascinating as the narrative itself. the notes in the back. I counted roughly 800 interviews and probably more manuscript collections. Where did you find all of this material? How do you do it?
Well, one thing worth mentioning is, in those days, it was a Secret Service rule that if you were assigned to a presidential or vice presidential detail, and there was an incident, and the assassination is an incident, but any incident involving the president or vice president, you had to type up a written report at the first available opportunity for your chiefs in Washington. I think there were 14 agents, I might have that number wrong, in that motorcade. So I said, basically, at the Johnson Library, is there anywhere in this library the reports of those Secret Service agents? They were there.
Bob, something else you describe in that moment, this horrific moment, is also that a side of Johnson emerged almost immediately that even friends hadn't seen. He'd had the reputation for all his power and might and bullying presence. He was also suspected of not having great physical courage.
Yes.
And yet just a switch gets flipped in a moment and he becomes a different kind of man.
Well, that's a good image. The switch gets flipped in a moment. You know, he has three friends of his are in this cubicle in the hospital. In front of him is a Secret Service agent. In the next room, two Secret Service agents. And at the door are Secret Service agents who have been told, don't let anyone past you unless you know his actual face. Johnson is standing there, and the people say he turned into a different man. Lady Bird said it was like his face was a graven image carved out of bronze. Everybody who knew Lyndon Johnson knew that while most of the time he yelled and screamed over every little thing, and if he had a cold, you'd think he was dying of pneumonia. But they also knew that when things were tough, Lady Bird said he's a good man to have around when things get tough, that he gets very calm and quiet, and he's standing there, and everybody who's in that room, the two Texas congressmen, one of his aides, and Lady Bird, say, you know, he stood there, he hardly moved, and you don't know what he's thinking. And he's standing there for 40 minutes, he doesn't know. And then Kenny O'Donnell, Kennedy's a very close aide, walks into the room, and Lady Bird Johnson says, seeing Kenny's stricken face, we knew. And he walks over to Johnson, who is now the 36th President of the United States. And Johnson immediately starts making decisions, hard, fast decisions. How do you get out of the hospital? Where am I going to get sworn in? How do we get to the plane? Bang, bang, bang. On the plane, going back, you know, you say you have a transition period. They say, so now you have an 11-week transition period, and everyone says 11 weeks are not long enough.
You mean after a normal election?
After a normal election. After this transit, he has 2 hours and 6 minutes on the plane.
That's the flight from Dallas to Washington?
Correct, on Air Force One. The flight that just before it takes off, there's the iconic photograph where he is sworn in next to Jackie. He turns around after the swearing in and says, now let's get airborne. You know, as that plane is going back to Washington, because everyone's afraid it's an international conspiracy.
Right, nobody knows what's behind this plot.
No one knows. And all along the route, at every air base, fighter pilots are strapped into their jets, Air Force fighter pilots, in case there's some danger to the plane. And on the plane, he makes a list of the things he has to do first. He steps off the plane at Andrews Air Force Base. He gives this very brief talk. It's the first time America has seen their new president. And then he goes over to the executive office building. He doesn't go to the White House because it's Kennedy's office, and takes command. And to watch Lyndon Johnson grab the reins of power of the presidency, just grab them, keep America on course and set it on, in some ways, on a new course. If you care about political power, this is, to me, thrilling. It was thrilling to learn about it.
And yet also, Bob, something you said was so striking to me very early in the book, that one reason Johnson, who for most of his life had dreamed of being president, thought he couldn't be elected was because he was from the South,
yes.
Which is a mind-boggling notion now, yeah. Because so many of our presidents are either Southerners or from the Sun Belt. He was the first in the modern era. Why was it so difficult? Why did he think or assume he couldn't possibly be elected on his own?
He assumed it, and he was probably right. because he couldn't get the nomination, because in the Democratic Party, the big states that controlled the most votes in the Electoral College were all northern liberal states who were very suspicious of the South. Civil rights is what brought it to a head. And there was so much suspicion and dislike of the Southerners that it was going to be very hard for a Southerner to win in the balloting and get the Democratic nomination. And he did say, no one from the South will be nominated in my lifetime.
And in fact, before him, none had. Going back to Zachary Taylor, as you point out. And yet, what our listeners will know is that Johnson was the author of the greatest civil rights legislation in our history. So did he change? Did the country change? How did he go from being perceived as a somewhat conservative Southern Democratic legislator to one of the great liberal presidents of the modern age?
You know, that aspect of Johnson, it was always present. He always wanted to help poor people, and particularly poor people of color. But he has to not really let that out, because his base of power in the Senate is the South, it's the other Southerners. In the first 3 or 4 days, I forget which night,
this is after the assassination, after when he's taking power.
Yeah. After the assassination, as in fact President Clinton picked this out in his review of the book, and he picks out the right sentences, they're discussing what Lyndon Johnson should say in his first speech. And his advisors, they're up around the dining room table writing this speech in his house. And they're saying to him, you know, you'll never get a civil rights bill through. It's a lost cause. The Southerners control Congress. Don't use up your capital on a lost cause. And Johnson says, well, what the hell's the presidency for? Later, you know, he says, I was a school teacher at a Mexican school when he was in college. And he says, you know, I swore then if I could ever help these kids, I was going to do it. And he says to Richard Goodwin, one of his aides, and I tell you something, now I have the power and I mean to use it. And he does change, and he becomes the greatest president since Lincoln in the cause of civil rights.
Bob, you've written now the fourth volume of this monumental work. The total page count is something like 3,300 pages. There is one more volume to write, you think? We haven't seen the final passage of those great bills. There's Medicare, and of course there's a tragedy of Vietnam, which rounds out the story. Do you think all of this next material can be covered in a single volume, or can we expect even more from you?
Well, I'm telling you it will be covered in a single volume, but why should you believe me?
Thanks so much, Bob Caro.
Pleasure to be here.
That's Robert Caro, whose new book, The Passage of Power, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So Amazon, the Kindle, Target, what's happening here?
Target was the first brick-and-mortar retailer to start selling the Kindle. This was just about 2 years ago. The Kindle at that point was only sold on Amazon.com. And Amazon really saw this as a bit of a disadvantage. They were competing against Barnes & Noble, which was selling its Nook device in 700 stores around the country. So Amazon decided to follow suit and start pursuing brick-and-mortar retailers and get them to start selling the Kindle. So what happened this week is that Target said that it would no longer do so, that it was going to pull Kindles, was going to sell out its remaining stock, and then it was going to stop selling them entirely.
Now, Target is a hugely successful retailer, so it makes sense for Amazon to sell the Kindle there, one would think. Makes sense for Target to be able to sell the device. What happened?
It made a lot of sense. Target has almost 1,800 stores around the country. It's one of the bigger carriers of Kindles in the offline world. And for Amazon, it was a great partner because with e-readers, people really want to touch them, try them out, see what they look like. You know, this isn't like someone buying a new phone where they're kind of going to know what it's like. This is a brand new device to a lot of people that they've never even seen before.
And selling it just on their website deprives potential customers of that opportunity to test one out.
Exactly, to ask questions about it, to see what it looks like, to feel how heavy it's going to be in your bag.
Okay, Julie, so we have a pretty good partnership. How did it break down? Where did the problems begin?
Well, Target has been very unhappy with a practice that's become known as showrooming. And this is simply the practice of a customer going into a store and checking out prices and then leaving the store and buying it online. And Amazon, which is pretty much the Walmart of the web, has really been benefiting from this practice. And in fact, they've been encouraging it explicitly. Over the holidays, for example, Amazon offered a promotion on what it calls its Price Check app, which is a mobile app that gave shoppers 5% off any item that was scanned at a store. So they were basically telling their customers to go into a Target, go into a Walmart, a bookstore, any kind of brick and mortar retailer, scan an item with their mobile device, and if Amazon had a cheaper price, then they would give them a discount on it on Amazon. So you can imagine that Target was not very happy about this.
And here it is, Amazon's own device. So it's as if Amazon is using Target as a showroom to bring customers back to the website to buy the Kindle, their own product there instead.
Right, and not just the Kindle, but toilet paper and baby products and anything else that's sold at Target that Amazon might be offering a cheaper price. And granted, they have an advantage because in many places, Amazon doesn't charge sales tax. So it's hard for Target and other brick and mortar retailers that have plenty of other overhead costs to compete with that. So it seems that Target was upset with Amazon for doing this, and that may have been a very big player in their decision to drop the Kindle.
And what does Amazon have to say about this? What's their side of the story?
Amazon, in an unsurprising response, did not respond. They are not saying anything at this moment. What analysts have said is that this probably won't annoy Amazon too much unless other retailers start following suit. One analyst that I talked to yesterday said that retailers like Target carrying Amazon's Kindle is a little bit like Starbucks selling Dunkin' Donuts gift certificates in their stores. It doesn't really make sense. So it might be that the other stores, like Walmart, like Best Buy, Staples, some of these other stores might kind of realize that this isn't a great idea and get in line and join the Amazon backlash.
Julie, Amazon is in a fairly tense conflict now with some of the great book publishers in America. The major book publishers were actually, you know, sued, it appears, or the Department of Justice has accused them of price fixing. There's great hostility between them and Amazon. And many have come to the defense of the publishers and said it's actually Amazon who's the bully here and not the victim. Now we have Amazon locked in combat with Target. At what point does public perception of Amazon begin to change a little bit, that it's not just the friendly retailer, as you say, the Walmart of the web where you can get everything for a great price, and begin actually to seem like a bit of a bully in this world of commerce? Is that happening at all? Does Amazon care what the public thinks?
It's hard to know what Amazon cares about, but I do think that there is a little bit of a backlash going on, and a lot of it really happened over the holidays when customers responded to Amazon's Price Check app and saw that as just a really blatant move that, you know, insulted a lot of brick and mortar retailers that, you know, are paying taxes to their local communities, that are contributing to their neighborhoods in a way that Amazon is not because it's online only. You also have a buy local movement that I think really has taken hold in many parts of the country. So, you know, you have a lot of people who are opposed to Amazon and retailers like it. I was at a literary event a few weeks ago in Brooklyn, and Anne Patchett, the author and independent bookseller now, gave a speech where she said something along the lines of, "You cannot buy books at Amazon. If you care about literary culture, if you care about the publishing industry, this is something you cannot do." And I think that that message, you know, while it's certainly taken hold in Brooklyn, has a good chance of spreading beyond.
So maybe we're looking at Occupy Amazon.
Maybe.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
There's nothing we like better at the Book Review than being able to tell readers about a really accomplished first novel. And we have one this week. It's called The Lifeboat. Its author is Charlotte Rogan. It's reviewed by Sarah Towers, who calls it an impressive, harrowing first novel. She says Rogan writes viscerally about the desperate condition of the castaway we're going to be describing and is by turns astute, comic, and affecting. And I'm delighted that Charlotte's here to talk about her book. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so you've kind of created the classic dramatic situation. I remember the movie Lifeboat. But you've also got specific historical circumstances and one character in particular. So tell us about this.
Well, my inspiration for writing the book came from my husband's criminal law text. I picked it up one day and started to read it, and I was particularly intrigued by two 19th century cases where shipwrecked sailors were put on trial after being rescued. Everybody's thinking Titanic these days, and I guess you could say that this story picks up where the Titanic leaves off, in that my characters were not rescued 4 to 6 hours after entering the lifeboats. They're in the lifeboat for 3 weeks. The Titanic, though, was not really one of my inspirations. I was more interested in the moral dilemmas of a lifeboat situation.
Now, before we get to that, listeners are going to want to know right away, why were these sailors prosecuted for having mishandled the situation they were in?
Well, interestingly, for many, many years, shipwrecked sailors thought they were protected by something called the custom of the sea. And that was an unwritten code of conduct meant to govern the actions of people who found themselves beyond the reach of any sort of civil authority. And that included things like that the captain should be the last one to leave a sinking ship and that the women and children should be saved first. And it also held that the concept of necessity made it acceptable to kill other people in order to survive, so long as those people were chosen fairly by the means of a lottery or something. But the court started to notice that the victims who were chosen supposedly in this fashion always seemed to be the natural victims, the weakest ones. And it was some of these shipwreck cases that I found in the legal text that were the cases where the courts finally made it illegal to kill someone in order to save yourself.
Okay, so now we have Grace Winter, whom our reviewer, Sarah Towers, is as much anti-heroine as heroine. Tell us about her.
Now that I've had the chance to talk to people about this book, she's been called everything from an anti-heroine to an antagonist. One person called her evil, and then there was a lovely woman on Twitter who said she was the most endearing, honest character she'd come across in a long time. So I will leave it to the reader to decide about Grace, but she is clearly unreliable in her narration.
And who is she?
She's a 22-year-old woman who has recently gotten married. She accompanied her then-fiancé to London on a business trip. He's a banker. They get married in London in order to escape the clutches of his mother, who isn't happy about this match.
And so they travel to London, right?
Correct.
On an ocean liner.
Correct.
Then there is you say it's not based on the Titanic, but a Titanic-like
Correct.
Catastrophe. Then they're on the lifeboat.
Right.
And for how long?
It's a total of 3 weeks.
And how many of them are there?
They start up with 39. The lifeboat is overcrowded. It supposedly was meant for 40 people, but they find out later after they're rescued that the owners of the ship had skimped on the specifications in order to save money. So with 39 people, this lifeboat is always in danger of sinking.
So they have to dispense with some.
They come to that point. When the weather gets bad, they are faced with a dilemma.
And where is Grace in the midst of all this? She is how influential a figure among this group of survivors, threatened survivors?
Grace is an observer. She is not a particularly influential character. A power struggle does develop in the lifeboat, and it splits along gender lines. The lifeboat has more females in it than men. I read an interesting book when I was doing research for this book. It was called In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex. It's by Nathaniel Philbrick, and it's a nonfiction account of the sinking of the ship that Moby Dick was based on. It was, the ship was sunk by a giant sperm whale. But this nonfiction account was very interesting because it brought in psychology and lots of things that novels don't explicitly bring in. And he cited some survival psychologists saying that in the early stages of a disaster, people want an authoritarian figure, a quick decision maker, sort of a typical alpha male to take charge. But as time wears on and the disaster gets old, people start to look for more nurturing, consensus-building types. And that describes one of the female characters in the boat. So there's sort of a tension between the male sort of leadership and the female sort of leadership, and that comes to a head about 2 weeks into the ordeal.
So you've researched this quite extensively. You really began with a legal text that gave you the germ of the idea for the novel. You've been writing novels for a while.
I have.
And so tell us about that.
Well, I started writing when I was in my mid-30s. That's 25 years ago. I took a creative writing class just to sort of see if I could. I decided I was going to write a novel, and that seemed to me a good way to start. One of the first creative writing teachers I had was Harold Brodkey, and he was something of a well-known literary figure in New York and a complete genius. But he didn't mince words with the class, and he told us that people who wanted to be liked could never be writers, and the merest hint of success would stop a writer in his or her tracks. So in the 25 years, I wrote 5 novels, published nothing. No worries about the pitfalls of success for me.
You tried to get them published.
I did. I made vague attempts. I'm not someone who makes contacts. I'm not someone who likes writing the business query letters. So now and then, in a fit of, you know, I'm going to do this, I would decide that I was going to try to get a manuscript published, and I would send it out. And over the course of that time, I did have a couple agents. None of those efforts ever came to anything until just a series of, you know, one thing leads to another. I met a woman who introduced me to her literary agent, and he sold the lifeboat to Little Brown.
So in the course of your apprenticeship, let's call it, were you getting better and better as a writer?
You know what? That's good that you brought that up, because I always felt I was getting better. I think I started with dialogue, because I would hear the characters talking to me in their head or talking to each other in their head. I think I'm a little paranoid because they're always defending themselves against something. And Grace appeared to me that way, sort of defending herself against some unseen authority for her actions in the boat. But starting with dialogue, then I would go on to, you know, work a little more on characterization or description or whatever it might be. And finally, I realized I better worry about plot, because even though it's not the first thing I read for, it probably is the first thing that most readers read for. And I think in The Lifeboat, I finally paid attention to plot.
And who were or are some of the novelists that you've learned from? Are there writers you read particularly closely?
Yes. I have a life list of inspirational novels or writers. I mean, it's long. I add maybe 5 or 6 writers a year to that list. I have on there Knute Hamsun, Hunger is his novel that particularly affected me. Harold Brodkey was one of those writers, Milan Kundera, Jean Stafford, Willa Cather, Death Comes for the Archbishop.
And when you read these novelists, let's say Willa Cather or Knute Hamsun, are you reading that novel once quickly, or rereading it, breaking it down sentence by sentence or scene by scene to see how it works?
John Barth gave his writing students the advice to stop reading innocently. These are novels I did not read innocently. Even if I read them that way the first time, I went back. And they're dog-eared. I open them at pages. Oh, I'll tell you another one. Herman Brock, The Death of Virgil. That's a novel I have never read from start to finish, and I never will. But you can open that book at any page and be inspired. It's amazing. And I read them for different things. Henry James is great on dialogue. Herman Brock is amazing just for the sentences, the poetry of it. So I read them for different things. I'd say Milan Kundera, I probably read him for characterization. Each one, though, yes, I will take them and just open them if I need inspiration and read a couple pages and kind of think, how did he create that effect or how did she do it?
And what are you working on now?
Well, I'm so superstitious about talking about what I'm working on now. My husband and I were lucky enough to spend a very short year for me in Johannesburg. It was not a year for me. It was a year for him. After we moved from Dallas, he was transferred to Johannesburg. So I started a novel there that's set in Johannesburg. And I'm just probably not going to say much more.
Well, you've told us just enough to make us look forward to it. Thanks so much, Charlotte.
Well, thank you.
That's Charlotte Rogan, whose first novel, The Lifeboat, is reviewed in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Really, there's not a lot. On the nonfiction side of things, there's just two new books on the hardcover list. They're both fairly high. Number three is Madeleine Albright's new memoir, Prague Winter. It's not the first memoir she's written. Back in 2003, you'll remember, she had a political memoir, Madam Secretary. That was a fairly conventional book, looking at her political career as Secretary of State. The new one is much more personal. It's a family history, a look back at her childhood. She was born in Czechoslovakia and then had to flee with her family to London during World War II. They briefly returned to Prague after the war, and then they soon thereafter moved to the United States. So she's telling that story in this
book. So that was the period of, well, the coup in Czechoslovakia and sort of the communization of the country.
Yeah, you know, her personal history was really shaped by politics and political unrest and really set her on the path that she followed throughout her career then.
What else have we got?
At number two, the only other new book on the nonfiction list this week is a memoir and sort of generational history by our former op-ed columnist Anna Quindlen. It's called Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. It's largely a book about aging, aging well, aging gracefully, looking back at kind of the baby boomer years, shared generational experiences. It's a pretty feel-good book. Unlike somebody like Nora Ephron, there's not a lot of neurosis in this. Anna Quindlen feels just fine about getting older. And she says now that she's in her late 50s, heading towards 60, she feels much more fearless than she used to. Once you get past 50, you just stop caring what other people think, she says. So you speak your mind and you do what you want to do.
Well, I have to say, Anna Quindlen came in for the podcast when her last novel came out. And boy, the word aging is not one that would even cross your mind. She's just so smart and so much vitality.
And that, of course, has been a trademark. I mean, she was pretty young when she had the Times op-ed column.
I think in her 30s.
Yeah. And then when she left newspapers.
Oh, she was a hugely important figure in journalism.
Yeah. So over on the fiction side of things, then there are three new books. I say new books, but one of them at number 14, Karen Marie Moning's new fantasy, Into the Dreaming. It's new on the list, but really it first came out in 2006, and this is a repackaged new edition of it with bonus material. It's a novella. She writes these fantasy novels set in old-time Scotland. They're the Highland fantasies that she writes. Number five, there's a new romance by Amanda Quick, who's really Jane Ann Krentz. Jane Ann Krentz, of course, a longtime romantic bestseller. She started writing some paranormal romances some time ago under the pen name Amanda Quick, and this is one of those. It's called Crystal Gardens. And then the new number one book this week is also new to the list. It's by Stephen King. His JFK novel fell off the list just about a month ago, and now, here 4 weeks later, he's got a new book on the list, The Wind Through the Keyhole. This is the eighth book in his Dark Tower series. It's a series of Western fantasy novels that he wrote. It's the eighth book that he wrote, but chronologically it really falls between the fourth and fifth books in the series. He calls it Dark Tower 4.5. Uncharacteristically for King, he's had a lot of trouble bringing these books to the screen. People have been trying for at least 5 years now. J.J. Abrams signed up and then dropped it. Universal, for a time, was trying to bring them to the screen. Then HBO was brought in for talks. I think Ron Howard is still signed up to produce, and they're hoping at some point to bring Dark Tower to the screen in some form.
I'm going to tell you something that I have told Stephen King's publishers, editors at Scribner's, when they mention some hardship. Do not sit here across the table from me and ask me to take pity on Stephen King. It's not happening.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks a lot, Greg. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week on Inside the New York Times Book Review. Remember, there's more at our website, nytimes.com/books. For the New York Times, this is Sam Tannenhaus.